He won 457-73. The parties began to drift apart like continents loosed. The Republican Party, influenced by conservative suburban housewives, began to move to the right. The Democratic Party, stirred by the moral and political urgency of the struggle for civil rights, began moving to the left. The pace of that drift would be determined by civil rights, the Cold War, television, and the speed of computation. How and where would Americans work out their political differences? In Yates versus the United States, the Supreme Court gutted the Smith Act, establishing that the First Amendment protected all political speech, even radical, reactionary, and revolutionary speech, unless it constituted a clear and present danger. But television broadcasters began to report that their audiences seemed to have an aversion to unpleasant information. "Television in the main is being used to distract, delude, amuse, and insulate us," Murrow complained. Magazine and newspaper writers made much the same complaint, finding that their editors were unwilling to run stories critical of American foreign policy. In Guatemala, when the CIA arranged to overthrow the democratically elected government of Jacobo Arbenz Guzman, who had seized hundreds of thousands of acres of land owned by the United Fruit Company, an American business, American reporters provided only the explanation given by Secretary of State Dulles, who insisted that Arbenz had been overthrown by a popular uprising. Correspondents from China, including John Hersey, protested at the editing of their own reports. From Luce's time, Theodore White threatened to resign. In a national security state where dissent was declared un-American and political contests were run by advertising firms, it was hard to know what was true. That bewildered cartoon voter had asked, "Who's right? What's right? What should I believe? What are the facts? How can I tell?" Maybe computers could tell. Screenwriters Phoebe Ephron and Henry Ephron toyed with that claim in the 1957 film Desk Set, starring Spencer Tracy and Katharine Hepburn, and made with the cooperation of IBM. Tracy plays an MIT engineer, a modern Frederick Winslow Taylor, who's invented an electronic brain. He turns up with a tape measure in the fact-checking department on the 28th floor of the Federal Broadcasting Company building. Hepburn, who plays the head of the department, invites him into her office. "I'm a methods engineer," he says. "Is that a sort of efficiency expert?" "Well, that term is a bit obsolete now." "Oh, forgive me," says Hepburn. "I'm so sorry. I'm the old-fashioned type." He's come to Hepburn's department to install a giant machine called Electromagnetic Memory and Research Arithmetical Calculator, EMARAC, or EMI for short, which requires pushing aside the desks of her assistants. Hepburn expects that her entire staff, replaced with this newest office robot, will be fired. Demonstrating how EMARAC works, Tracy makes a speech to a group of corporate executives. "Gentlemen, the purpose of this machine is, of course, to free the worker." "You could say that again," Hepburn mutters. "To free the worker from the routine and repetitive tasks and liberate his time for more important work." He points to the wall of books. "You see all those books up there and those up there? Well, every fact in them has been fed into EMI." "No one will ever need to consult the book again," Tracy promises. "In the future, the discovery of facts will require nothing more than asking EMI." Hepburn, asked what she thinks of EMI, answers archly, "I think you can safely say that it will provide more leisure for more people." Desk Set played on its audience's fear of automation, of machines that would make workers redundant. But more bracingly, it offered a proposal about mass democracy and the chaos of facts. Citizens find it impossible to gather all the information they need to make an informed decision about a political issue. They're easily deluded by television and other forms of mass media and mass advertising. They struggle to sort through fact and fiction. But computers have no problem handling a vast store of knowledge. They are animated only by logic. They are immune to persuasion. It seemed possible, it had certainly been Mockley's dream, that computers would help people become better citizens, that the United States would become a techno-utopia. Desk Set wondered, instead, whether computers had about them the whirring mechanical menace of totalitarianism, another cross of iron. 4. Thurgood Marshall was born in Baltimore in 1908, the son of a steward who served at an all-white resort, and a kindergarten teacher who taught at all-black schools. He knew about the color line. He knew about it as intimately as a prisoner knows the walls of his cell. Marshall first read the Constitution when he was made to study it as punishment for raising hell at school. "Instead of making us copy out stuff on the blackboard after school when we misbehaved," Marshall later explained, "our teacher sent us down into the basement to learn parts of the Constitution." He pored over every word. He figured he'd found the key to the lock on that cell door. His parents wanted him to become a dentist, but after working his way through college as a dining car waiter on the B&O Railroad, he decided he wanted to be a lawyer. He'd learned his pride and how to argue from his father during arguments at the dinner table. Whenever he'd say something smart, his father would say, "Why, that's right black of you." Unable to attend the segregated University of Maryland Law School, a 10-minute trolley ride from his family's house, he instead went to Howard, which required riding in segregated railroad cars 40 miles each way. Graduating first in his class in 1933, he 2 years later successfully sued as counsel the state of Maryland, arguing that because the state provided no law school for African Americans, it had defied the separate but equal doctrine of the Supreme Court's 1896 ruling in Plessy v. Ferguson. By 1950, Marshall had convinced the NAACP to abandon this line of argument, demanding equal facilities, in favor of arguing against separation itself. Marshall started the NAACP's Legal and Educational Defense Fund right after he won his case against the state of Maryland. As its chief counsel, he argued hundreds of cases across the South as part of a years-long strategy to end Jim Crow, at one point carrying as many as 450 cases at once. He started with higher education, law schools and professional schools, and worked his way down to colleges, with the idea of eventually challenging segregation all the way down to the kind of kindergarten classrooms where his mother had taught. It had taken him a long time to convince colleagues at the NAACP to abandon equalizing arguments in favor of integration. Equalizing had always been a means to end segregation, if gradually, the idea being that states would eventually be broken by the cost of maintaining separate schools if they had to be genuinely equal. But by 1950, African Americans had challenged Jim Crow in the military and in housing, and had also gained more political power. The great migration of blacks to the North and West meant that nationally, anyway, large numbers of black men and women could vote, even if 80% of blacks in the South were still disenfranchised. By the middle of the decade, television, too, would argue in favor of making a leap in civil rights litigation. Southern racial violence and intimidation, long hidden from view outside the South, could now be seen in living rooms across the country. Aiming to bring a challenge to segregation in the nation's public schools to the Supreme Court, an objective endorsed by Truman's Justice Department, Marshall began building a docket of cases in 1951. Several were eventually consolidated under the title case concerning a third grader named Linda Brown, who lived in Topeka, Kansas. Her father, Oliver L. Brown, a welder and part-time pastor, wanted her to go to a school blocks away from their house, but Topeka's segregated school system assigned Linda to a school a long walk and a bus ride away, an hour of travel each way. Oliver Brown agreed to join a civil suit against the Topeka Board of Education, filed by the NAACP's Legal Defense Fund. The case was called Brown v. Board of Education. On the eve of oral arguments in December 1952, Marshall was near to physical collapse from overwork. At the Supreme Court building, a line began to form before dawn, men and women bundled against the morning frost in winter coats and hats. Oral arguments lasted 3 days. Justice Stanley Reed asked Marshall whether segregation wasn't in the interests of law and order. Marshall was willing to stipulate, for the purpose of argument, that maybe it had been when the court decided Plessy. "But even if the concession is made that it was necessary in 1895," he said, "it is not necessary now because people have grown up and understand each other." Marshall offered the court a singularly hopeful picture of American race relations. "I know in the South, where I spent most of my time," he said, "you'll see white and colored kids going down the road together to school. They separate and go to different schools, and they come out and they play together. I do not see why there would necessarily be any trouble if they went to school together." Justice Felix Frankfurter asked Marshall what he meant by equal. Marshall, 6'4", his wavy black hair slicked back, his thin mustache as pointed as a punctuation mark, Newsweek once described him as a rumpled bear of a man, answered with his slight southern drawl, "Equal means getting the same thing at the same time and in the same place." John W. Davis, the 78-year-old former Solicitor General, U.S. Ambassador to Britain, and Democratic presidential candidate in 1924, argued the other side, stressing states' rights and precedent. A formidable opponent, Davis had made 139 appearances before the court. This would be his last, he asked. "Is it not a fact that the very strength and fiber of our federal system is local self-government in those matters for which local action is competent? And on tradition, there is no reason assigned here why this court or any should reverse the findings of 90 years. But Marshall's argument, strenuous and intricate, aimed to lift from the shoulders of African Americans the weight of history. Instead of arguing from precedent, Marshall borrowed from Louis Brandeis. He presented the findings of social science. In establishing the constitutionality of Jim Crow laws, Plessy v. Ferguson had cited the customs and traditions of the people. Marshall presented the court with reams of empirical research on the consequences for black children of separate schooling. Jim Crow laws, Marshall told the court, are black codes, and the only way the court could possibly uphold them, he said, would be to find that for some reason, Negroes are inferior to all other human beings. As the court was keenly aware, the case to end segregation was aided by the conditions of the Cold War itself. The United States billed itself as the leader of the free world and fought against the Soviets for influence in emerging polities in the Third World, but frequently found itself indicted for its racial order at home. When the finance minister of Ghana, on a visit to the United States, stopped at Howard Johnson's in Delaware and tried to order orange juice, he was told that blacks were not allowed in the restaurant. When the Haitian Secretary of Agriculture was invited to Biloxi, Mississippi for a conference, he was told he was unable to stay at the conference hotel. "Can serious people still speak of American democracy?" asked one Haitian newspaper. Newspapers from Bombay to Manila reported on Jim Crow. The Negro question was one of the principal themes of Soviet propaganda, the U.S. Embassy in Moscow reported. And so when the Topeka case first reached the Supreme Court, Truman's Justice Department urged the court to overturn Plessy, partly on the grounds that legally sanctioned racial discrimination in the United States undermined American foreign policy aims. "Racial discrimination furnishes grist for the communist propaganda mills," said Attorney General James P. McGranary, "and it raises doubts, even among friendly nations, as to the intensity of our devotion to the democratic faith." In his brief, the Attorney General included two pages written by Dean Acheson, the Secretary of State, emphasizing the cost of Jim Crow at home to the United States' reputation around the world. "Racial discrimination in the United States remains a source of constant embarrassment to this government in the day-to-day conduct of its foreign relations," Acheson reported, "and it jeopardizes the effective maintenance of our moral leadership in the free and democratic nations of the world." Desegregation had become a matter of national security. As the oral arguments ended, Davis was overheard saying, "I think we've got it won, 5-4, or maybe 6-3. He'd read the bench well. When the justices began their deliberations in closed session, Chief Justice Fred Vinson, a Kentucky Democrat, opened by noting that precedent did indeed support segregation. Vinson thought it would be better if the desegregation of schools came from Congress, and that if the court acted ahead of popular opinion, public schooling in the South might effectively be abolished because segregationists would rather close their schools than admit blacks. Reed, also from Kentucky, said that he thought the time to end segregation would come when the body of the people thought it was unconstitutional, which hadn't happened yet. Like Reed, Justice Robert Jackson said he thought if the court had to decide this question, then representative government has failed. Frankfurter, a longtime liberal, who once on the court had become its most dogged opponent of judicial activism, wanted, like Texan Tom C. Clark, to delay. Frankfurter had served on the NAACP's Legal Defense Committee and had hired a black law clerk, the court's first, in 1948. But as much as Frankfurter wanted segregation to end, Marshall hadn't convinced him that it was unconstitutional. Roosevelt appointee and former Columbia University law professor William O. Douglas thought the whole thing was very simple. "The 14th Amendment prohibits racial classification." Hugo Black from Alabama was one of the strongest voices in opposition to segregation, even though he himself had been a member of the Klan in the 1920s, a blot that he strained to scrub clean. Had the justices then taken a straw vote, which they did not, it appears likely that 4 would have found segregation unconstitutional, 2 would have reaffirmed Plessy, and 3 would have been uncertain. Worried about the political consequences of a divided decision, a worry that extended to mass violence, Vinson decided to reschedule the case to be re-argued in December 1953. All bets on the outcome of the case were called off, though, when on September 8, 1953, Vinson died altogether unexpectedly of a heart attack. Eisenhower, who had, in an effort to unite a divided Republican Party, named his rival and Nixon's great political enemy Earl Warren as his Solicitor General, had also at the time promised Warren a seat on the court. When Vinson died, Eisenhower appointed Warren as Chief Justice, a position Warren would hold for 16 years, presiding over the most liberal bench in the court's history. Brown v. Board was the first case the Warren Court tackled. Warren, opening the discussion, saw the case entirely differently than had Vinson. "Separate but equal doctrine rests on the basic premise that the Negro race is inferior," he began, agreeing with Marshall that the only way to sustain Plessy was to agree with the premise of racial inferiority, which was impossible, he said, because the argument of Negro counsel proves that they are not inferior. Warren's vote, added to the four justices who in the earlier session made clear they believed segregation to be unconstitutional, meant that Warren's argument would prevail 5-4, even if no other justices joined his side. The justices' clerks nearly unanimously supported Warren's position, all but a young William Rehnquist, as he made plain in a memo to his boss, Justice Jackson. I realize it is an unpopular and unhumanitarian position for which I have been excoriated by liberal colleagues, Rehnquist wrote, but I think Plessy v. Ferguson was right and should be reaffirmed. Nixon would appoint Rehnquist to the court in 1971. The court was scheduled to hand down its decision on May 17, 1954. The NAACP was so uncertain how the court would decide that it prepared two press releases, one for either possible decision. Reporters flooded the galleries. The decision had been made unanimous. Justice Jackson, in the hospital recovering from a heart attack, came to court that day, so committed was the court to a display of unity. Warren delivered the opinion he'd written about the nature of change over time. In approaching this problem, we cannot turn the clock back to 1868 when the amendment was adopted, or even to 1896 when Plessy v. Ferguson was written, he insisted. We must consider public education in light of its full development and its present place in American life throughout the nation. Only in this way can it be determined if segregation in public schools deprives these plaintiffs of the equal protection of the laws. In assessing the evidence, not of the past but of the present, the conditions in American schools, he concluded that separate educational facilities are inherently unequal. At least on paper, Jim Crow was over. Much of the public greeted the decision with elation and joy, nowhere better captured than in a photograph of a young mother sitting on the steps of the Supreme Court, cradling her young daughter in the crook of her arm, holding in her lap the next day's newspaper with its outsized front page headline, High Court Bans Segregation in Nation's Schools. Warren's opinion was greeted with near equal pleasure by Cold Warriors, who called it a blow to communism. Even the Republican National Committee, granting Eisenhower credit for a decision that Truman's Justice Department had pursued, celebrated the court's ruling, stating that it helps guarantee the free world's cause. But not all civil rights activists had supported Marshall and the NAACP's legal strategy. Not all African Americans wanted their schools to be desegregated, which often resulted in black teachers losing their jobs. And many who did nevertheless placed greater priority on other political goals. In a 1935 essay called Does the Negro Need Separate Schools? W.E.B. Du Bois had written about something almost ineffable in a teacher's understanding of the world of her students. Dissenters within the NAACP found that its willingness to bring the fight for civil rights to the courts came at the expense of securing better jobs, equal pay, and fair housing. In Atlanta, home to five historically black colleges and universities, nearly half the city's public school teachers were black, and of those, three-quarters were black women. Black teachers had been lobbying the legislature for equal pay and for equal funding for black schools. Atlanta lawyer A.T. Walden had begun filing pay equity suits on behalf of the city's teachers in 1942, and the next year had filed a class action suit with Thurgood Marshall. In 1950, when Marshall turned the NAACP strategy to integration and Walden began pursuing desegregation cases, the editor of the Atlanta Daily World was among the most outspoken of those black leaders who objected, arguing that much would be lost for black children sent to white schools, especially at a time when the legislature, under growing grassroots pressure, was beginning to move on equalizing funds and opening new black schools. The strongest reservations were those of black school teachers. Even in Topeka, they wanted no part of the effort to desegregate the schools. After Brown, they continued to be skeptical. Marshall did not hide a frustration laced with contempt. We will try to convert them to our way of thinking, he said days after the ruling, but we will walk over them if they get in our way. Among whites, especially in the Jim Crow South, Brown was met with swift and sustained resistance. Eisenhower had been dismayed by the ruling. I am convinced that the Supreme Court decision set back progress in the South at least 15 years, he said privately. The fellow who tries to tell me you can do these things by force is just plain nuts. Segregationists prepared for battle. There is nothing in the United States Constitution that gives the Congress, the President, or the Supreme Court the right to declare that white and colored children must attend the same public schools, said Mississippi Senator James Eastland. And a new movement began called Impeach Earl Warren. The court urged schools to desegregate with all deliberate speed. Some schools in cities and towns like Washington and Baltimore complied. The overwhelming majority did not. In some cities like Atlanta, where many black families were deeply ambivalent about the NAACP's legal strategy, the school board dragged its feet, and black activists and black teachers' unions didn't press them. In other cities, all white school boards simply refused to budge. In 1955, in 8 states in the South, not a single black child attended school with a white child. The Richmond News Leader wrote that year, "In May of 1954, that inept fraternity of politicians and professors known as the United States Supreme Court chose to throw away established law. These 9 men repudiated the Constitution, spit upon the 10th Amendment, rewrote the fundamental law of this land to suit their own gauzy concepts of sociology. If it be said now that the South is flouting the law, let it be said to the High Court, you taught us how." The court could disavow Jim Crow, but it would take a fight to dismantle it. Sometimes that fight took place at the very doors of public schools, where black children were placed on the front lines. It also took place on buses and in restaurants, in acts of defiance that had become more commonplace in the 1940s, even if they had been rarely reported. After Brown, reporters took notice. On December 1, 1955, in Montgomery, Alabama, Rosa Parks, a 42-year-old seamstress, refused to give up her seat on a bus to a white man. Parks, born in Tuskegee, had joined the NAACP in 1943 when she was 30. Secretary of her chapter, she'd worked on voter registration and the desegregation of transportation. Parks had made a purposeful decision to challenge segregated seating on the city's buses. The driver stopped the bus and asked her to move, and when she again refused, he called for police, who arrested her. The next night, a 26-year-old minister named Martin Luther King Jr. was drafted to lead a citywide protest that would begin the following Monday, December 5th. Born in Atlanta in 1929, the son of a minister and NAACP leader, King had been inspired by evangelical Christianity, by the liberal theologian Reinhold Niebuhr, and by anti-colonialism abroad, particularly by the rhetoric and tactics of nonviolence practiced by Mahatma Gandhi. King had wide-set eyes, short hair, and a pencil mustache. Ordained in 1948, he'd attended a theological seminary in Pennsylvania and then completed a doctoral degree at Boston University in 1955 before becoming pastor at the Dexter Avenue Baptist Church in Montgomery. Lean and quiet as a young man, he'd grown sturdier and more stirring as he mastered the ancient art of preaching. On the 5th, with less than a half hour to pull together a speech for a mass meeting to be held in Montgomery's Holt Street Baptist Church, he found himself with a few moments to spare when on his ride to the church, traffic all but stopped. Cars snaked through the city. More than 5,000 people had turned up, thousands more than the church could fit. King climbed to the pulpit. The crowd, while attentive, remained hushed until he found his rhythm. "As you know, my friends," King said, his deep voice beginning to thrum, "there comes a time when people get sick and tired of being trampled over by the iron feet of oppression." Pressed into the benches, people began stomping their feet and calling out, "Yes! I want it to be known throughout Montgomery and throughout this nation that we are a Christian people," King said as the crowd punctuated his pauses with cries. "The only weapon we have in our hands this evening is the weapon of protest." Joining a tradition of American oratory that dated back to the day Frederick Douglass concluded that he could make a better argument against slavery if he decided the Constitution was on his side instead of against him, King called this protest an American protest. "If we were incarcerated behind the iron curtains of a communistic nation, we couldn't do this," he said, pausing for the thunder of assent. "If we were trapped in the dungeon of a totalitarian regime, we couldn't do this." It was as if the roof might fall. "But the great glory of American democracy," his voice swelled, "is the right to protest for right." Parks had been arrested on a Thursday. By Monday, 90% of the city's blacks were boycotting the buses. Over 381 days, blacks in Montgomery, led by Parks and King, boycotted the city's buses. King, indicted for violating the state's anti-boycott law, said, "If we are arrested every day, if we are exploited every day, if we are trampled over every day, don't ever let anyone pull you so low as to hate them." On November 13, 1956, the Supreme Court ruled that the Montgomery bus law was unconstitutional. Early the next year, King founded the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, SCLC. If the civil rights struggle of the 1950s was aided by the Cold War, it was fueled by a spirit of prophetic Christianity. a political movement and a legal argument, civil rights was also a religious revival. "If you will protest courageously and yet with dignity and Christian love," King promised his followers, "when the history books are written in future generations, the historians will have to pause and say, there lived a great people, a black people, who injected new meaning and dignity into the veins of civilization." The historians have obliged. Under King's leadership and by the courage of those who followed him and those who paved the way for him, a commitment to civil rights became not only post-war liberalism's core commitment, but the nation's creed. But blood would be shed. Justice William O. Douglas always blamed Eisenhower for the years of violence that followed the court's ruling in Brown, a decision the president, who did not ask Congress for a stronger civil rights bill, never publicly endorsed. Eisenhower, Douglas said, was a national hero, worshipped and adored. If he had gone to the nation on television and radio, telling people to obey the law and fall into line, the cause of desegregation would have been accelerated, Douglas said. Instead, Ike's ominous silence on our 1954 decision gave courage to the racists who decided to resist the decision, ward by ward, precinct by precinct, town by town, and county by county. Arvill Faubus, Democratic governor of Arkansas, wasn't personally opposed to integration. He sent his own son to an integrated college outside of town. But the sentiment of his constituents, who were nearly all white in a state where blacks were regularly blocked from voting, led him to consider opposition to school desegregation a political opportunity too good to miss. He sought an injunction against desegregation of the schools, and the state court agreed to grant it. Thurgood Marshall got a federal district court to nullify the state injunction, but on September 2, 1957, Faubus went on television to announce that he was sending 250 National Guardsmen to Central High School in Little Rock. "If any black children tried to get into the school," Faubus warned, "blood will run in the streets." The next day, before any black children had even arrived, a white mob attacked a group of black newspaper reporters and photographers. Alex Wilson said, as he was knocked to the ground, "I fought for my country, and I'm not running from you." On September 4th, when 15-year-old Elizabeth Eckford tried to walk to the school, the white students cried, "Lynch her! Lynch her!" Television coverage of black students confronted by armed soldiers and a white mob wielding sticks and stones, and worse, stunned Americans across the country. The state of Arkansas had authorized armed resistance to federal law. While Eisenhower dithered over how to handle the crisis in Little Rock, Congress debated the 1957 Civil Rights Act, the first civil rights legislation since Reconstruction. It established a Civil Rights Commission to hear complaints, but granted it no authority to do anything about them. "It was like handing a policeman a gun without bullets," said one Justice Department official. Eleanor Roosevelt, as distinctive and influential as an ex-First Lady as she'd been when in the White House, called the law mere fakery. One senator said it was about as substantial as soup made from the shadow of a crow which had starved to death. Longtime advocates of civil rights, including Richard Nixon, argued for stronger legislation to no avail. But the 1957 Civil Rights Act set a precedent, and it was galling enough to segregationists that Strom Thurmond, who filibustered against it for more than 24 hours, set a new record. The bill was made possible by the wrangling of Lyndon Johnson. True to his Texas constituency, if not to his principles, Johnson had voted against every civil rights bill that had faced him in his career in the House and Senate from 1937 to 1957. But he'd never been a segregationist. He'd publicly supported the court's decision in Brown v. Board, and he believed the time had come for the Democratic Party to change direction. Johnson was also eyeing a bid for the presidency, and he needed to be seen as a national politician, not a Southern Democrat. He courted and counted votes better than any other Senate majority leader ever had, and the bill passed. "Mob rule cannot be allowed to overrule the decision of our courts," Eisenhower said on television, and ordered 1,000 paratroopers from the 101st Airborne Division to Arkansas, the same division that had dropped from the sky over Normandy on D-Day. On September 25, 1957, U.S. federal troops escorted 9 black teenagers to high school. Americans watching on television reeled. They reeled again when, on October 4, 1957, the USSR launched a satellite into orbit. Anyone with a shortwave radio anywhere in the world could listen to it. As it made its orbit, it emitted a steady beep, 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 like the ticking of a heart. In the United States, a nation already on edge at the specter of armed paratroopers escorting children into a school, Sputnik also created a political panic. The next obvious step was putting a nuclear weapon in a missile head and firing it by rocket. In both the race to space and the arms race, the Soviets had pulled ahead. The Cold War would keep overshadowing the civil rights movement and also propelling it forward. The battle to end segregation in education was far from over. Faubus, who'd earned the nickname "That Sputtering Sputnik from the Ozarks," decided to shut down Little Rock's high schools rather than integrate them. He declared, "The federal government has no authority to require any state to operate public schools." 2 weeks after Sputnik was launched, Eisenhower met with the nation's top scientific advisors, asking them to tell him where scientific research belonged in the structure of the federal government. That meeting led in 1958 to the creation of the National Aeronautics and Space Agency. NASA would establish operations in Florida and Texas and fund research in universities across the former Cotton Belt, the science and technology business-friendly New South, the Sun Belt. That meeting also led to the creation of the Advanced Research Projects Agency as a branch of the Department of Defense. It would be based in the Pentagon. One day, it would build what became the Internet. In February 1958, after Sputnik, and 1 month after Eisenhower announced ARPA, the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists' Science and Security Board moved the atomic doomsday clock to 2 minutes before midnight. The hands of time seemed at once to be moving both forward and backward. Thurgood Marshall looked back at the late 1950s in dismay. "I had thought, we'd all thought, that once we got the Brown case, the thing was going to be over," he said bitterly. "You see, we were always looking for that one case to end it all, and that case hasn't come up yet." That case did not come. Equality was never going to be a matter of a single case, or even of a long march, but instead of an abiding political hope. Chapter 14. Rights and Wrongs. Nikita Khrushchev, stout and swaggering beneath a wide-brimmed white hat, looked like a circus barker. Richard Nixon was dressed like an undertaker. "Knock them dead in Russia," Nixon's television advisor had cabled him. "This is the most important trip of your life." Nixon, 46, went to Moscow in the summer of 1959, eyeing a presidential bid as the unsteady leader of a faltering party. The Republicans had been badly drubbed in the 1958 midterm elections, losing 48 seats in the House and 13 in the Senate, and Democrats had won both Senate seats in the new state of Alaska. Nixon, keen to take advantage of the spotlight of a televised meeting with the Soviet premier, wanted to deliver to Americans shaken by Sputnik a technological triumph, or, at the very least, a little machine-made political magic. Nixon had traveled to Moscow to open an exhibition. The United States and the USSR, unable to launch rockets without risking mutually assured destruction, had agreed to stage a proxy battle of the merits of capitalism and communism. At the Soviet Exhibition of Science, Technology, and Culture, held at the New York Coliseum, the Russians put a space satellite on display alongside a gallery that housed a model Soviet apartment, its kitchen outfitted with a samovar. Its counterpart, the American National Exhibition, mounted inside a 10-acre pavilion in Moscow's Sokolniki Park, answered with electric coffee pots, offering visitors a tour of American consumer goods, especially home appliances of the sort that manufacturers pledged would spare women the drudgery of housework. One American family man, exactly capturing the spirit of the thing, wrote Eisenhower that he had a better idea. "Why don't you let a typical American family make up an exhibit?" He said he'd be happy to bring to Moscow everything anyone in the Soviet Union needed to understand typical living, honest-to-goodness, truthful and democratic-loving Americans. Striped toothpaste, a Dairy Queen cone, frozen pink lemonade, a GI insurance policy, his set of golf clubs, the family's 1959 Ford station wagon, and two plump daughters, ages 10 and 11, complete with hula hoops, brownie and Girl Scout outfits, and a Monopoly set, and polio shots. The president did not take him up on the offer. In Moscow, a grinning, dark-suited Nixon cut the ribbon to open the American exhibit alongside beaming, striped-tied Khrushchev. Inside, they sparred over the rewards of capitalism and communism, while touring galleries stocked with vacuum cleaners and dishwashers, robots and cake mixes, garbage disposals and frozen dinners, a showcase meant to display the American way of life, abundance, convenience, and choice. The bottles of Pepsi were free. Stopping at a makeshift television stage, the two men fell into an argument, Khrushchev toying with Nixon like a bear playing with a fish. "You must not be afraid of ideas," the vice president scolded the premier. Khrushchev laughed. The time has passed when ideas scared us. Nixon pointed out that color television and the video recording of their meeting, American inventions, would lead to great advantages in communication, and that even Khrushchev might learn something from American ingenuity. Because after all, Nixon said with a stiff smile, you don't know everything. You know absolutely nothing about communism, Khrushchev shot back. Nothing except fear of it. Awkwardly, they wandered the exhibit hall. I want to show you this kitchen, Nixon said, excitedly ushering the premier to a canary-yellow, appliance-filled room and calling his attention to a washing machine and a television. Dear people also have a machine that opens their mouth and chews for them, Khrushchev prodded. Nixon dodged and parried. Still, he stood his ground. The press dubbed it the kitchen debate and declared it a draw, but American photographers captured Nixon standing tall and fighting back, poking a finger in Khrushchev's chest, and the visit was a triumph. For the United States, it was, in any event, a triumphant time. At the height of the Cold War, more Americans were earning more and buying more than ever before. The affluent society, the economist John Kenneth Galbraith called it in 1958. The fundamental political problems of the Industrial Revolution have been solved, the sociologist Seymour Martin Lipset wrote confidently in Political Man in 1960. For most of human history, the overwhelming majority of people have suffered from want. Industrialism had promised to end that suffering, but it turned out to produce vast fortunes only for the few, crushing the many under its wheels. Progressives and New Dealers had tried to lift those wheels. They'd legislated all manner of remedies and forms of mitigation, from a graduated federal income tax to maximum hour and minimum wage laws, from Social Security to the GI Bill. Since 1940, inequalities of wealth and income had been dwindling. Even while checked by the Constitution, the growing power of the state, exercised most dramatically in huge fiscal expenditures, especially military, and funded by a progressive income tax, made possible unprecedented economic growth and a wide distribution of goods and opportunities. By 1960, 2 out of 3 Americans owned their own homes. They filled those homes with machines, dishwashers, vacuum cleaners, electric mixers and blenders, refrigerators and freezers, record players, radios and televisions, the engines of their own abundance. So high a standard of living, so widely distributed, had never been seen before. Nearly all throughout history have been very poor, Galbraith wrote. The exception, almost insignificant in the whole span of human existence, has been the last few generations in the comparatively small corner of the world populated by Europeans. Here, and especially in the United States, there has been a great and quite unprecedented affluence. The economy a juggernaut, the triumph of liberalism and of Keynesian economics, seemed to many American intellectuals all but complete. The remarkable capacity of the United States economy in 1960, one economic historian concluded, represents the crossing of a great divide in the history of humanity. Not only had the problems of industrialism been solved, many social scientists believed, but so had the problems of mass democracy with the emergence of a broad and moderate political consensus, as seen on television. Notwithstanding the ongoing struggle over civil rights, Americans fundamentally agreed with one another about their system of government, and most also agreed on an underlying theory of politics. In The End of Ideology on the Exhaustion of Political Ideas in the 50s, sociologist Daniel Bell argued that socialism and communism had bloomed and withered. Ideology itself was over. For ideology, which once was a road to action, has become a dead end. Political debates lay ahead, tinkering around the edges, repairs to the appliances of government. And certainly in Asia and Africa, new ideologies had emerged. But in the West, Bell insisted, the big ideas of the left had been exhausted, replaced by consensus. The acceptance of the welfare state, the desirability of decentralized power, a system of mixed economy, and of political pluralism. Some younger Americans, left and right, found Bell's argument ridiculous. It's like an old man proclaiming the end of sex, said one. Because he doesn't feel it anymore, he thinks it's disappeared. Others suggested that Bell had failed to notice a rising tide of conservatism. But Bell hadn't ignored conservatism. He'd discounted it. In 1955, he'd edited a collection of essays called The New American Right. Joseph McCarthy, to Bell's contributors, was a man without ideas. The puzzling thing about McCarthy, Dwight MacDonald wrote, was that he had no ideology. As for the writings of economists like Friedrich Hayek, Bell dismissed them as nonsense. Few serious conservatives, wrote Bell, believe that the welfare state is the road to serfdom. Considerable empirical evidence, in fact, supported Bell's theory of consensus. At the University of Michigan, political scientists had been conducting interviews with voters every 4 years since 1948. They'd ask voters questions. Would you say that either one of the parties is more conservative or more liberal than the other? Between 1948 and 1960, many voters could not answer that one. Others answered badly. The research had asked the follow-up. What do people have in mind when they say that the Republicans are more conservative than the Democrats? Voters found this kind of question difficult to answer, too. The bottom 37% of respondents could supply no meaning for the liberal-conservative distinction, and only the top 17% gave what the interviewers deemed best answers. Everyone else fell somewhere in between, but the researchers were pretty sure that a whole bunch of them were just guessing. Ideologically minded politicians and intellectuals talked about liberalism and conservatism for sure, but to ordinary voters, these terms had virtually no meaning. Elaborating on these findings, which were published in 1960 in a landmark study called The American Voter, the political scientist Philip Converse produced an influential essay, The Nature of Mass Belief Systems in Mass Publics, in which he divided the American electorate into political elites and the mass public. Political elites are exceptionally well-informed, follow politics closely, and adhere to a set of political beliefs so coherent, or, as Converse termed, so constrained, as to constitute an ideology. But the mass public has only scant knowledge of politics, resulting in a very loose and unconstrained attachment to any single set of political beliefs. Converse argued that the Michigan voter interviews revealed that political elites know what goes with what, laissez-faire with free enterprise, for example, and what parties stand for. Democrats favor labor, Republicans business. But much of the mass public does not. Political elites vote in a more partisan fashion than the mass public. The more a voter knows about politics, the more likely he is to vote in an ideologically consistent way, not just following a party, but following a set of constraints dictated by a political ideology. What makes a voter moderate, Converse concluded, is not knowing very much about politics. In the 1950s, there were a lot of moderates. What no one could quite see in 1960 was the gathering strength of two developments that would shape American politics for the next half century. Between 1968 and 1972, both economic inequality and political polarization, which had been declining for decades, began to rise. The fundamental problems of the Industrial Revolution had not, alas, been solved, nor had the problems of mass democracy. Even as social scientists were announcing the end of ideology, a new age of ideology was beginning. By 1974, when Richard Nixon announced his resignation from the presidency, sitting before blue drapes in the Oval Office, 15 years after his debate with Nikita Khrushchev in the canary yellow kitchen in Moscow, liberalism had begun its long decline and conservatism its long ascent, and the country was on the way to becoming nearly as divided and as unequal as it had been before the Civil War. 1. Galbraith wasn't happy about the affluent society. He found it complacent and smug and too willing to accept poverty as inevitable. The prosperous society, he thought, was a purposeless one. He called for higher taxes to build better hospitals and schools and roads to repair the public sector. Americans shrugged and turned on their televisions. But beneath the cheerful gurgle of the percolating electric coffee pot could be heard a muffled thrum of despair. It began with a fear of the perils of prosperity, laziness, tastelessness, and purposelessness. "We've grown unbelievably prosperous, and we maunder along in a stupor of fat," the historian Eric Goldman complained. One journalist called the 1950s the age of the slob. It was also the age of the snob. Dwight MacDonald memorably lamented the rise of packed, boxed, and price-tagged middlebrow mass culture. Mass cult, he dubbed it, as if it were a soft drink, especially in the form of trashy paperback novels and ticky-tacky TV shows produced for the sprawling and suburban middle class by corporations, arbitrated not by taste but by sales and ratings. Art is the creation of individuals and communities, MacDonald argued. Middlebrow culture is a product manufactured and packaged for the masses. Mass cult is bad in a new way, MacDonald wrote. It doesn't even have the theoretical possibility of being good. After Nixon came back from Moscow, the Eisenhower administration announced a new resolve to discover a national purpose. The year 1960 was a time when Americans stopped taking their national purpose for granted and started doing something about it, Life reported. Eisenhower appointed 10 eminent men, politicians and editors, business and labor leaders, and the presidents of universities and charities, to a commission on national goals and asked the commission to identify a set of 10-year objectives for the United States. A striking measure of the artificial nature of the era's liberal consensus, every member of the commission was a white man over the age of 45. Yet the goals the commission would set would be steered above all by black college students who, beginning in 1960, and without a blue ribbon committee of eminent men, made civil rights the nation's purpose. On Monday, February 1st, 1960, 2 days before Eisenhower named the new members of his Commission on National Goals, four freshmen from North Carolina A&T in Greensboro, North Carolina, refused to give up their seats at a lunch counter in a segregated diner inside a Woolworth's store. Theirs wasn't the first sit-in. Over the past 3 years alone, there'd been sit-ins in 16 cities, but it was the first to capture a national attention. That night, those four students called NAACP lawyer Floyd McKissick, who helped spread the word. They went back to Woolworth's the next day with friends. More came the day after that. They sat in shifts at vinyl and chrome stools. They set up a command center and kept track of plans being laid in Durham and Raleigh to stage sit-ins of solidarity. By the end of the week, more than 400 students were involved in the Greensboro sit-in alone. The movement spread to Tennessee and then across the South to Georgia, West Virginia, Texas, and Arkansas. It reached 40 more cities in March. Within months, 50,000 students had joined. Hundreds were arrested in Nashville. In South Carolina, police officers attacked demonstrators with tear gas and fire hoses, arresting nearly 400. Even students who doubted the philosophy of nonviolent protest began to see its power, as photographers captured images of thuggish whites pouring milk and squeezing ketchup onto the heads of college students sitting quietly at a lunch counter, or of angry, armored policemen beating them with clubs or dragging them down sidewalks. The students' protests even earned the admiration of some hardened pro-segregation Southern newspaper editors, including the editor of the Richmond News Leader. Here were the college students in coats, white shirts, ties, and one of them was reading Goethe, and one was taking notes from a biology text. And here, on the sidewalk outside, was a gang of white boys come to heckle, a ragtail rabble, slack-jawed, black-jacketed, and grinning fit to kill, and some of them, God save the mark, were waving the proud and honored flag of the Southern states in the last war fought by gentlemen. Ugh, it gives one pause. Ella Baker, acting director of the SCLC, arranged to invite the student leaders to an organizing meeting on Easter weekend in April. Baker, born in Virginia in 1903, had been a longtime organizer for the NAACP as a field secretary beginning in 1938 and as a director of branches across the South in the 1940s, working on, among many other projects, the campaign to win equal pay for black teachers. She'd agreed to join the SCLC in 1958 to head an Atlanta-based voter registration drive known as the Crusade for Citizenship. But she'd been frustrated by Southern preachers' relative inattention to voting rights, and she found Martin Luther King Jr. too self-centered and cautious. In 1960, when SCLC tried to convince Baker to persuade the students to join as a junior chapter, Baker, in a stirring speech, refused, and instead urged the students to start their own organization. She didn't say, "Don't let Martin Luther King tell you what to do," Julian Bond later recalled. But she got the real feeling that's what she meant. Distancing themselves from both the NAACP and the SCLC, which many students found altogether too conservative, they founded the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, SNCC. They raised an army. Their weapon was nonviolent direct action. Baker left the SCLC to join them. Later in 1960, when Eisenhower's 10 distinguished commissioners delivered their report, they wrote that discrimination on the basis of race must now be recognized as morally wrong, economically wasteful, and in many respects dangerous, called for federal action to support voting rights, urged the denial of federal funds to employers who discriminate on the basis of race, and insisted upon the urgency of ending segregation in education. Although the final report wasn't published until after the November election, its key findings were released earlier, and more than one observer remarked that the report, while prepared for the Republican White House, aligned very well with the campaign promises made by Democratic presidential candidate John F. Kennedy. "If there were not abundant evidence, Senator Kennedy has been fully occupied with other things lately," said CBS's Howard K. Smith. "One would swear he wrote the document." Before that fall, the presidential prospects for Kennedy, the dashing Irish Catholic from Boston, had not seemed especially good. Liberals distrusted him because of his silence on McCarthyism, and few had much confidence in him. K. Kennedy, 43, was both young and inexperienced. Lyndon Johnson called him the boy. Kennedy prevailed in part because he was the first packaged, market-tested president, liberalism for mass consumption. Weighing the possible party nominees and its platform, the Democratic National Committee, uncertain how to handle the question of civil rights, turned to a new field called data science, a term coined in 1960, to predict the consequences of different approaches to the issue by undertaking the computational simulation of elections. To that end, the DNC in 1959 hired Simulmatics Corporation, a company founded by Ithiel de Sola Poole, a political scientist from MIT. Poole and his team collected old punch cards from the archives of George Gallup and pollster Elmo Roper, the raw data from more than 60 polls conducted during the campaigns of 1952, 1954, 1956, 1958, and 1960, and fed them into a UNIVAC. Using high-speed computation and a simulation model developed out of historical data, Poole aimed to both advance and accelerate the measurement of public opinion and the forecasting of elections. This kind of research could not have been conducted 10 years ago, Poole and his colleagues reported. Poole sorted voters into 480 possible types, explaining, a single voter type might be Eastern Metropolitan lower-income white Catholic female Democrats. Another might be border state rural upper-income white Protestant male independents. He sorted issues into 52 clusters. Most of these were political issues, such as foreign aid, attitudes toward the United Nations, and McCarthyism, he explained. Other so-called issue clusters included such familiar indicators of public opinion as which party is better suited for people like you. Simulmatics's work, which continued through the 1960s, marked the advent of a new industry whose implications for American democracy alarmed at least one of his colleagues, the political scientist and novelist Eugene Burdick. Famous for the 1958 bestseller he co-authored with William Lederer, The Ugly American, and the 1962 novel Failsafe, written with Harvey Wheeler and made into a film directed by Sidney Lumet, Burdick published a novel called The 480, about the work done by Simulmatics, a fictional expose of what he described as a benign underworld in American politics. It is not the underworld of cigar-chewing, pot-bellied officials who mysteriously run the machine. Such men are still around, but their power is waning. They are becoming obsolete, though they have not yet learned the fact. The new underworld is made up of innocent and well-intentioned people who work with slide rules and calculating machines and computers, which can retain an almost infinite number of bits of information, as well as sort, categorize, and reproduce this information at the press of a button. Most of these people are highly educated, many of them are PhDs, and none that I have met have malignant political designs on the American public. They may, however, radically reconstruct the American political system, build a new politics, and even modify revered and venerable American institutions, facts of which they are blissfully innocent. They are technicians and artists. All of them want desperately to be scientists. The premise of Simulmatics's work, as Burdick saw all too clearly, was that if voters didn't profess ideologies, if they had no idea of the meaning of the words liberal and conservative, they could nevertheless be sorted into ideological piles based on their identities, race, ethnicity, hometown, religion, age, and income. Simulmatics's first commission, completed just before the Democratic National Convention in the summer of 1960, was to conduct a study on the Negro vote in the North. So few black people were able to vote in the South that there was no point of simulating their votes, Poole concluded. Poole reported discovering that between 1954 and 1956, a small but significant shift to the Republicans occurred among Northern Negroes, which cost the Democrats about 1% of the total votes in eight key states. The DNC, undoubtedly influenced by the viscerally powerful student sit-ins, absorbed Simulmatics's report and decided to add civil rights paragraphs to the party's platform at its convention in Los Angeles in July. Civil rights had not been among Kennedy's priorities as a member of the Senate, but the protests and the predictions altered his course. Needing to win both black votes in the North and white votes in the South, Kennedy decided to run as a civil rights candidate to woo those Northerners and chose Lyndon Johnson for his running mate, hoping that the Texan could handle the Southerners. The DNC found Simulmatics's initial report sufficiently illuminating that after the convention, it commissioned Poole to prepare three more reports on Kennedy's image, on Nixon's image, and on foreign policy as a campaign issue. Simulmatics also ran simulations on different ways Kennedy might talk about his Catholicism. He ought to employ frankness and directness rather than avoidance, Simulmatics advised. Kennedy therefore gave a frank and direct speech in Houston on September 12, 1960, I believe in an America where the separation of church and state is absolute, where no Catholic prelate could tell the president, should he be Catholic, how to act, and no Protestant minister would tell his parishioners for whom to vote. Meanwhile, Nixon, without much help from Eisenhower, who snubbed him, won the Republican nomination. Campaigns, Inc. ran his campaign in California. The great need is to go on the offensive and to attack, according to the firm's plan of campaign, which advised Nixon to forget the liberal Democrats who wouldn't vote for Nixon if he received the joint endorsement of Jesus Christ and Karl Marx via a seance with Eleanor Roosevelt. In the spirit of going on the offensive, Nixon agreed to debate Kennedy on television in a series of exchanges. I would like to propose that we transform our circus atmosphere presidential campaigns into a great debate conducted in full view of all the people, Adlai Stevenson had urged in 1959. But it was Kennedy, a man one notable columnist called Stevenson with Balls, who made it happen. On September 26, 1960, Nixon and Kennedy met in a bare CBS television studio in Chicago, without an audience. The event was broadcast live by CBS, NBC, and ABC. By now, nearly 9 in 10 American households had a television set. Nixon was sick. He'd been in the hospital for 12 days. He was in pain, and he was unprepared. A skilled debater who'd enjoyed nothing but political gain from his appearances on television, and most lately from the kitchen debate, he'd been barely briefed for his appearance with Kennedy. The rules were the result of strenuous negotiating. The very scheduling required Congress to temporarily suspend an FCC regulation that required giving equal time to all presidential candidates. There were hundreds. Much negotiation involved seemingly little things. Nixon wanted no reaction shots. He wanted viewers to see only the fellow who was talking, not the other guy. But Kennedy wanted them, and Kennedy prevailed with this concession. He agreed to Nixon's stipulation that neither man be shown wiping the sweat from his face. Then there were bigger things. Each candidate made an 8-minute opening statement and a 3-minute closing statement. The networks wanted Nixon and Kennedy to question each other. Both men refused, and instead insisted on taking questions from a panel of reporters, one from each network, a format that is more generally known as a parallel press conference. ABC refused to call what happened that night a debate, billing it instead as a joint appearance. Everyone else called it a debate. 66 million Americans watched Nixon scowl, and the misnomer stuck. On October 19th, 2 days before the last of the candidates' 4 scheduled debates, Martin Luther King Jr. was arrested in Atlanta during a lunch counter sit-in. He'd waited a long time before joining the sit-ins, but now he was in and he was sentenced to 4 months of hard labor. Kennedy called King's wife, Coretta Scott King. His brother Robert intervened and got King out of jail. Nixon, who had a much stronger record on civil rights than Kennedy, did nothing. He later came to believe that this lost him the election, one of the closest elections in American history. Kennedy winning by a hair's breadth, 34,221,000 to 34,108,000. Nixon came to believe that the results had been rigged, and he may have been right. There appears to have been Democratic voter fraud in Illinois and Texas. 13-year-old young Republican Hillary Rodham volunteered to look for evidence of fraud in Chicago. "We won, but they stole it from us," Nixon said. Nixon blamed Democrats. He blamed black voters, and above all, he blamed the press. 2. The youngest man ever elected president, John F. Kennedy, replaced the oldest man ever to hold the office. With his hand resting on a Bible carried across the ocean by his Irish immigrant ancestors, Kennedy looked more like a Hollywood movie star than like any man who had ever occupied the Oval Office. Wearing no overcoat, his every exhale visible in the freezing cold, he proclaimed his inauguration on January 21, 1961, to mark the beginning of a new era. "The torch has been passed to a new generation of Americans born in this century, tempered by war, disciplined by a hard and bitter peace, proud of our ancient heritage." Kennedy had taken that torch from Eisenhower. 3 days before the inauguration, Eisenhower delivered a farewell address in which he issued a dire warning about the U.S.-Soviet arms race. "In the councils of government, we must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex," he said. "Only an alert and knowledgeable citizenry can compel the proper meshing of the huge industrial and military machinery of defense with our peaceful methods and goals, so that security and liberty may prosper together." Kennedy, in his inaugural address, echoed his predecessor. Neither can two great and powerful groups of nations take comfort from our present course, both sides overburdened by the cost of modern weapons, both rightly alarmed by the steady spread of the deadly atom, yet both racing to alter that uncertain balance of terror that stays the hand of mankind's final war. One of the first acts of his administration was the announcement of the Peace Corps in March 1961. But during a presidency that began